The nuclear crisis continues in Japan.
What effect is all of this having on the U.S. economic recovery?
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for downloading the podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, St. Patrick's Day.
Indeed.
Yes, happy St. Patrick's Day,
Jeremy. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Coming up, why are the prices at some gas stations so much cheaper than the prices at other gas stations? Also, how did CBS turn its fortunes around when it comes to the NCAA basketball tournament?
Those stories and many more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/marketplace.
In Sendai, Japan today, heavy machinery and helicopters are digging through neighborhoods completely destroyed by last Friday's disaster. Thousands of residents in northern Japan displaced by last week's earthquake and tsunami are trying to find some sense of normal.
The power is out for nearly a million people who are in desperate search for supplies. We are following the stories of the human and the economic tragedy. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz traveled to Sendai, and he's with us right now. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Steve.
What did you see there? I mean, have they made any progress in that area?
Well, they've still got a lot of work to do. I've never seen anything like this. I visited a neighborhood completely washed away by a 30-foot-high surge of ocean water. I saw houses upside down, cars on top of each other, and then beneath all of this are telephone poles, lumber, electric wire. And then if you look even closer, you start to see household objects, plates, vacuum cleaners, a Sony PlayStation. I saw a child's half-finished homework. And it was all strewn about, stuck in thick mud. It was just an incredibly sad scene that reminds you that families lived and died here.
My goodness, that's something so harsh. But how is the local economy there, Rob, faring nearly a week after this earthquake?
It's still barely functioning. When we drove into Sendai today, we saw lines a mile long at gas stations, lines of people outside any place that had food. Evacuation centers are running low on food and supplies. It's clear the supply chain is still broken here. An older gentleman named Rikyo Yamano was my taxi driver today. His taxi runs on natural gas, something that's more plentiful now than gasoline, but he was still having problems. Here's Rikyo. Here he's telling me that each day since the quake, he lines up at the natural gas filling station at 6 in the morning. He says he usually gets to fill up his tank at around 2:30 in the afternoon. So Sendai's economy clearly still has problems, and the weather today certainly didn't help. Mr. Yamano was pretty close to getting us into an accident a few times today. That's because we were driving on mountain roads in a snowstorm. So first you had the quake, then the tsunami, then the radiation release, and now a rather large snowstorm, all contributing to a standstill for the local economy here.
So many things happening over there. All right, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz in Japan. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, as the world watches the efforts to stave off a meltdown at the troubled nuclear plant in Japan, economists are watching the Japanese currency, the yen. It's hit its highest level against the U.S. dollar since World War II. Let's get more now from Marketplace's Stephen Beard. He's with us from London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, first of all, it seems like the yen would be falling right now, given all the turmoil in Japan. Why is it rising?
Well, analysts say what's happening here is that Japanese insurance companies are bringing their foreign investments home because they face insurance claims running into the tens of billions. They're selling their investments in the US and in Europe and bringing the cash home. Converting that money into yen is what's pushing up the Japanese currency, they say. But the Japanese government says, no, the yen is rising because of speculators.
Well, either way, Stephen, a good thing or a bad thing for Japan to have a rising yen right now?
In the short term, it's not that bad because it means Japan will be able to buy more of the foreign supplies it urgently needs to import. Longer term, it's bad because an expensive yen makes Japanese exports more expensive.
And what about the effect on the United States economy?
Well, there's a long-term worry here. If we are seeing the Japanese taking their money home, since the US in particular has been relying on that money to pay for a big chunk of its government spending, this flight of Japanese money back to Japan could be bad for the US. Here's Steen Jacobsen of Saxo Bank.
It will leave a hole in the global recycling of capital. You can say that Japan and China has been paying for the deficit of the US and of Europe. If they stop recycling capital into this market, it leaves an empty hole which needs to be filled.
And how do you fill that empty hole? By pushing up U.S. interest rates and by cutting U.S. government spending quite sharply, and all that would hit American growth.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
Well, Japan is one of the U.S.'s largest trading partners, and the disaster there is affecting U.S. companies big time. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Damage from the earthquake in Japan is expected to top $100 billion. Natural disasters, even huge ones, usually don't have global economic consequences, says Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff. But he thinks this one could be different.
Particularly because of the implications for the nuclear power industry. It's very important in cars, electronics, high-end capital equipment. I mean, this is a huge, huge economy.
Bank of America released a list of the top 10 U.S. companies likely to be affected. Insurance giant Aflac headed the list. It does three-quarters of its business in Japan, and its stock has fallen 10% since the earthquake. Aflac CEO Dan Amos.
We've set up reserves for these type of events, and we should be in good shape. Now, it could change, but right now we feel comfortable with our position.
High-end retailers like Coach and Tiffany have also seen share prices fall. Japan accounts for about 20% of sales for the two companies. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
For more now on how global companies are reacting to events in Japan, we're going to talk with Stephen Badger. He's the director of Asia-Pacific operations for the international express shipping giant TNT. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How many staff do you have in Japan?
Just under 500.
And so far, everyone's safe and accounted for?
Yes, they are, which is very good. And that was critical.
Are you taking staff out of the country?
No, we're not. No, we have a 100% Japanese team. So there is none of the Japanese team want to leave the country. They're there, they're committed, and they want to continue to develop the organization.
What are you planning for at this point going forward? A quick return to normal operations or a long disruption if this nuclear crisis gets worse?
Well, first things, because this happened on the Friday, we immediately said, after we realized everybody was safe, we tried to identify hotels for accommodation, identifying ways that we could support the team. That was number one. Secondly, we had to identify what shipments were critical, things like healthcare, things like the clinical trial shipments, which are extremely important. Were they able to be exported on that day? Etc. So all of these we identified, and then over the weekend put contingency methods in to recover and put those to the closest local laboratories.
Have you ever dealt with any kind of crisis like this?
Not to the same extent, no. We've dealt with other crises as things came up. We had close to us here the Indonesia tsunami, very similar. So yes, we I would say quite experienced in this area, and when our business continuity plans in place, we bring those out. We might have to adjust, but they're in place.
Stephen Badger, Operations Director for TNT Express Asia Pacific, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. Visit squarespace.com/marketplace and sign up for a free trial. Then choose a design and color scheme that's uniquely you. That's squarespace.com/marketplace. We thank Squarespace for their support.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, the 17th of March. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. The Labor Department said this morning that Americans paid more for food and gas last month, but otherwise, price inflation was minimal. And the number of people filing for first-time unemployment benefits dropped to 385,000 last week, the third drop in 4 weeks. That's where we'll start with our market analyst this morning. Diane Swonk is off. We're pleased to be joined instead by David Kelly. He's chief market strategist with J.P. Morgan Funds, and he's with us from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, David, as I just said, the cost of the things we consumers are buying are going up. The number of people checking in at the unemployment office going down seems like okay news for our recovery. Is that your take?
I think that's right. I mean, nobody likes paying more for food and energy, but I think the big threat to the American economy in the last year has been deflation, and the numbers this morning suggest the inflation rate is basically stabilizing. Not that high a level, but it's going up. We also got some good numbers in manufacturing today. So with manufacturing output up, unemployment claims down, inflation stable, the U.S. economy does seem to be in a recovery mode.
All right, but the U.S. economy obviously is not in a vacuum, and we've had some significant drops in stocks here in the U.S. over the last couple of days as a result of what's going on in Japan. How much worry do you have about the situation in Japan derailing our recovery here in the U.S.?
Well, not that much. I mean, obviously, it's a terrible human tragedy. And I think for markets, the biggest problem is uncertainty. And I can't think of more uncertainty than the nuclear situation in Japan.
Right.
But provided that stabilizes, the reality is the Japanese economy, it's going to get hurt in the first half of the year, but it should do better in the second half of the year as they try and rebuild. And our exports to Japan are a very small part of our economy. So I think we should be able to weather this. And I think the main problem is really one for Japan itself.
David Kelly, Chief Market Strategist with J.P. Morgan Funds, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
To the U.S. banking system now and the money we taxpayers loaned the banks so they could stay afloat during the financial crisis. All told, the Treasury sent $245 billion to banks, and as of yesterday, has been paid back $244 billion. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
With repayments from a handful of big banks like Fifth Third Bancorp, the Treasury has now recouped 99% of the capital it injected into the U.S. banking system through TARP.
I see TARP as a failure, even though we've gotten all our money back in nominal terms.
Chris Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics says in order to pay back TARP, banks raised money in the capital markets and juiced their balance sheets.
What I would have preferred was to see the government give them the money and have them charge it off in terms of getting rid of bad assets. Because the poor economic performance that we're seeing, the high unemployment, is in part due to the fact that the banks have not restructured. They have just muddled along, especially the biggest banks.
There's also still hundreds of billions in taxpayer money outstanding that hasn't been paid back yet by the likes of non-banks, including AIG, GM, Chrysler, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac. Some of that may never be recouped. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Steve, you know the old question, Coke or Pepsi?
Yes, of
what
course.
What is your answer to that?
You're putting me on the spot, Jeremy. I'm a Coca-Cola guy.
I am a Coca-Cola guy, too. But we can throw that question out the window now because the new question should be Coke or Diet Coke. Beverage Digest expected to report today that for the first time, Diet Coke replaced Pepsi last year as the second most popular soft drink here in the U.S.
Wow. Maybe they should bring back Crystal Pepsi. No.
Maybe not.
The Clear Cola. No, I don't know. It's a war of words between the mayors of New York State's two biggest cities. At a housing and neighborhood conference yesterday, Jeremy, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg said this. There is an awful lot of free space in Buffalo, New York, if you want to go there. I don't think you do.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's like a, ooh.
That's rough.
Yeah, you don't want to go to Buffalo. Well, for his part, the Buffalo mayor, Byron Brown, said he grew up in the New York City borough of Queens, and he left the Big Apple. Guess where he wound up?
Buffalo.
He left New York and got to Buffalo.
That'll show him. That'll show him.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, March 17th. I'm Steve Chiotek.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm on Twitter as well, Radio Chio. You can also give us your feedback by checking out our website, marketplace.org, and clicking on the link that says Contact.
Well, oil prices are back on the rise today, around $100 a barrel in New York trading. They had been dropping because of concerns about the situation in Japan, though gas prices seem to stay the same. Steve, here in L.A., they're around $4 a gallon.
Indeed they are.
And there do seem to be some stations that I've found, and I'm sure you've seen these, where the gas is suspiciously cheap.
Yeah.
Here to fill us up with facts now is L.A. Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what gives with the gas that's slightly cheaper than the rest of the stations?
Oftentimes, gas tends to be a little more expensive when you drive around town, especially if you're nearer to a freeway or a commercial center,
right.
And that's called pricing to market. But the cheap stuff, typically, like ARCO, for example, how does ARCO get away with offering such cheap gas? I've been talking to a number of mechanics and energy experts about this, and on the one hand, they say, well, you've got your branded gas and your more generic gas,
right.
And the branded gas tends to have additives in it, and that might boost the price. But then that raises the question, are the additives any good? And the mechanics are mixed on that.
So if I go to a station at like Walmart or Costco, that's the non-branded gas. Is that bad for my engine?
I wish I knew. I put that to a lot of mechanics, and most of them said gas is gas. And I think that's the major takeaway of this. On the other hand, they did say, yes, there are differences. For example, you go to Chevron, it's got Tecron in it.
Right.
Is Tecron any good? Well, some mechanics told me, yes, it will actually help clean your engine. Others said, not so much. Maybe the generic stuff comes from the bottom of the barrel. I don't know.
So we've got pricing to market. We've got additives. Are those the only things that make the gas so different in different places?
No, I think the key thing we're looking at here is the business model. For example, ARCO. ARCO is almost always cheaper than other places around. How do they do that? They keep their gas prices low by just simply not taking credit cards, not having to pay the interchange fees that go along with that, and therefore passing those savings on to their customers. It's a model that works.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A year ago, CBS was thinking it was going to take a bath on the NCAA basketball tournament. You giving up with March Madness, Jeremy?
I'm trying to as best I can. I do like March Madness.
Absolutely. Well, the network was expecting to lose $200 million a year, maybe more. They considered even paying ESPN to take the tournament off their hands. But fortunes have changed, and new technology plus this cable deal have made CBS's coverage a slam dunk. Here's Marketplace's Steve Henn.
Mark Gannis runs the Chicago consulting firm Sports Corp. He says if CBS lost March Madness, it would have been devastating.
This is one of their marquee events. If this was lost, it would have had a very negative effect on the entire broadcasting company.
So the network looked for ways to expand the tourney's reach. It cut a deal with Turner Broadcasting to split the costs and increase the number of cable channels carrying games. And last year, CBS started streaming all the games online for free.
And the viewership was enormous, and they sold advertising for it, and they still had the in-game advertising. It turned out to be a real winner because most of the people who watched it on their computers were at work, and so it didn't cannibalize the TV ratings at all.
You just had to keep one eye out for your boss.
There actually was a boss button on the screen, so it would pop up like a spreadsheet as soon as your boss came around.
Yeah, unfortunately, the spreadsheet was really the bracket.
Seriously? Gannis thinks streaming big sporting events to PCs, mobile phones, and iPads is set to explode. And if he's right, in a few years, we might be watching the Olympics on YouTube. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
And finally, you know all those companies who tell you to follow them on Twitter and Facebook? I know we never do that.
No,
do we, Steve?
Ever,
never,
ever.
Never. Well, the event registration website Eventbrite has come out with actual numbers about the profitability of social networking. And the site says, on average, a tweet about an event brought in 80 cents in ticket sales during the past 6 months, and the average like on Facebook brought in $1.34.
Wow.
Liking APM Marketplace on Facebook, by the way, is priceless. But I didn't say that. That was
no, we didn't do
we
that.
We don't tell
at all.
You to follow at Jeremy Hobson on Twitter or
follow Radio Chio. Absolutely.
No, I've never said that.
I try not to. I shy away from it. Yeah.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.